Hi, and welcome to It's About Youth. I'm Fana Shea. This is the show that talks about things that matter to youth. And today we are tackling the topic of migrants and refugees, an important topic that may have been sidelined over the past years, also even decades, especially when we talk about comprehensive solutions in dealing with the group, either here or even abroad. Today we are joined by Hilda Pavate from Project RED, as well as Heidi Kwa from Refuge for the Refugees. Thank you so much for joining us, you both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, awesome. So before we start, you know, to get deep into the discussion here, let's begin with some of the issues facing refugees in Malaysia. Most of the refugee population here are Rohingya population, whom, as we speak, are making dangerous crossings at sea in search of safety. But you know, what awaits them here, Hilda?
Yeah. So as we know that Malaysia has not signed the 1951 UN Convention for Refugees, and that basically does not give them the right to legally work here. You know, they don't have access to education and they don't have access to healthcare. So I think, you know, looking at these three core issues, it may seem very mainstream, right? A lot of people know about it, but I think it seeps into their lives in so many different ways, right? In just a few weeks back, when I was talking to one of the community leaders, I found out that some of them actually stay in houses where there are 17 to 25 of them all together in one house because they need to save on money, they can't afford the rent, right? And I thought, like, this is something that would not be actually very safe for teenage girls, you know, to be staying with strangers, you know, and which then led to the discussion that these things actually do happen. There's sexual abuse happening in the house where they get molested by strangers who stay in the same house, right? So these are just issues that stems really from these three things that are happening currently. And I think if we were to talk about all the issues, there can be so many to unpack. But yeah, I think those are some things that I just recently discovered.
Yeah, what about you, Heidi?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at how, I mean, refugees, first of all, I think people don't truly understand what makes someone a refugee, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people look at refugees and they clump them, you know, together with migrants and illegal immigrants, thinking that everyone is pati, you know, they call it pendatang asing tanpa izin. But a lot of times, you know, people flee because of death threats, of persecution, of war, of violence. And when they come over to Malaysia, they already carry so much post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And having to acclimatize a new country without access to basic human rights is indeed, you know, a struggle. I think, you know, we need to first understand the complexities of having to acclimatize a new country. I was just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a refugee who traveled 1 month to come to Malaysia in a container, in a lorry. And in that lorry, four people passed away. And why he had to flee his country? Because the bombs were going off, right? Because he was being hunted down and having his life threatened.
Yeah, and this is sort of the struggles that they face daily, right?
Yeah.
And that we might not even, you know, when we see a Rohingya refugee, for example, you know, during your outreach program, we don't know because this is the kind of things that they face almost daily. Now, you mentioned just now the right to work, that they don't have access to right to work. Let's dive a little bit deeper on that because the right to work is essentially, you know, how people sustain their livelihood. It's important. So the HR minister announced recently that it has not made any decision on this yet. But Human Resources Minister last time, Dato' Sri M. Saravanan, also said that the government is working on a guideline on permission for refugees to work. Now, how feasible is it for this country to adapt or to give permission for refugees to work or to have some sort of framework for refugees to work? And what are the concerns and how do we move forward, Heidi?
I think, first of all, I think it's extremely feasible for us to provide refugees the opportunity to work, right? If anything, you know, access for, you know, refugees being given access to work will only benefit the country. And there's very little recourse from it. There's been a report produced by IDEAS, right? I mean, before that, you know, the right of work should be extended to refugees to secure their dignity, restore their livelihood and help them just be independent, contribute to the host country. A lot of times when we speak to refugee families on the ground, they tell us that, like, hey, we want to contribute to the country, but our hands are tied and we can't effectively contribute to the country. There's been a report published by IDEAS in 2019, actually, that reported that if refugees are allowed to work, they can contribute to the annual GDP. Their contribution to the annual GDP would increase to over 3 billion by 2024. I mean, that's staggering numbers through higher spending. And the wider economic impact, including including indirect effects, such as lower business costs, could also be substantially larger. Overall, Malaysians benefiting from refugees working, we have to understand that the benefits would increase if refugees were given legal right to work. And if they're given legal right to work, refugees can potentially create over 4,000 jobs for Malaysians as well. The report by IDEAS after deep research also shows that if given the right to work, their tax contributions would increase to over 50 million in taxes each year by 2024. And the total net contribution to public finances would also depend on policy decisions, right, including application for foreign worker levy as well as subsidised hospital rates for refugees. So I think, you know, there's so much benefits, you know, in just allowing refugees to work. All of them, we have to remember that, you know, they are not unskilled. Many of them are degree holders, are master holders. They're extremely skilled. They had homes, they drove big cars, they were contributing to their country before having to flee. And what if we get them acclimatized here? How do we integrate them into our community and give them job opportunities so that they can contribute towards nation building? As we know, Malaysia is a hub full of resources, right? Mm-hmm. We are very handy people. If we include refugees in our system by allowing them avenues to provide to practice their skills that they have developed back home, I think there's so much more we can do for our economy in general.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, like you mentioned just now, there's so much benefits to allowing them to work, but there seems to be a lot of pushback as well.
Yeah,
you know, this idea of getting refugees to work has been in the pipeline for so long, but has never been really implemented, you know, wholly. What do you think, Hilda? What is the stumbling block?
I think there's this concern, right? There's a lot of fear within the public of like, oh, they are here in search for better money. That's the common, I think, misconception that we have in Malaysia, right? They're here for better money, better lives. And they are looking for better lives, but they are also running away from for the sake of their safety, you know? And they also have that fear, right? So I think when we come with this sort of perception, right, oh, they are here to steal our jobs, oh, you know, if we let refugees work, then the locals are, you know, their livelihood is going to decrease. I think that's the kind of wrong mindsets that is probably the stumbling block that you mentioned, right? And I think in just allowing them to work, what we're actually really doing is that you're protecting their rights, because when you think about it, they have been here for quite some time, and it would have been impossible if they were not allowed to work. Yeah. So they are doing sort of informal work, right? Yeah. And with that, there's a common misconception that that's the only thing that they're good at. Or construction work, cleaning, you know, babysitting, because these are the only jobs that they're allowed to do. So the common misconception sort of make them feel, or make people think that they are low-skilled workers, but whereas like what Heidi mentioned, right, they're actually quite educated. I feel like I've talked to some people who actually have hired refugees to work part-time in their restaurants and all, and they always had good things to say about them. I personally have worked with them also, and they're very loyal, they're very hardworking, they have very strong entrepreneurship skills, which I think...
They're very resourceful.
Very resourceful, you know, I don't know whether it stemmed from survival mode or it's just inbuilt in them. But I think that helped them to sort of create the life that they need, right? And if we can tap into that and protect them, you know, hold the employers accountable, you know, to how they are treated, how much they're being paid, right? Then they will want to contribute more into the country and to the communities around them.
Now, a portion of this Rohingya population as well consists of children who are not able to get access to education, like you said just now. The right to education should be, you know, enshrined for all children, I think. So how can we ensure this right especially is further protected? Tell me a little bit on what you've done and what can government help you to do more?
So we started Project RED. Project RED is a learning centre for refugees. And we hold weekend classes where we focus a lot on character development. So now, as we know, I think UNHCR reports that only 33% of refugee children are actually in schools, community schools, not even in public schools, right? And because these community schools are run on volunteers, you know, they're run on public donations, it's very hard for them to have the right resources, the right capacity for teachers. So we hear of volunteers who have to be there the entire day looking after 30 to 40 children. So of course, the quality of education drops, right? And a lot of parents, I think when we talk to them, they do believe in the power of education in breaking out.
They do want to send their
kids. Yeah, they do. They're like, yeah. I believe that my child should have a degree, should have a master's, right? You know, but one, they don't know what are the future pathways available for them in Malaysia. It's very vague for them. And two, because they're only allowed to take like international papers, it's very expensive for them given that they have no legal rights to work. So it's a whole mess, right, over here. So what we felt was that how do we, in Project RIT, our focus was how do we better prepare a kid for uncertainties? Because we cannot predict where the kid is going to end up. Some of them might be resettled. Some of them might be sent back to their back to their country. Some of them might be here, you know. And what we want to do is we want to build that sort of resilience and leadership, right? No matter where you are placed, you'll be able to step out of it. And what we wanted to do so we wanted to create this platform of various opportunities for them to tap into, because like community schools, they have they focus a lot on academics. So we wanted them to exploring their interests. And I think with all of that said, education reformation for refugees, it's a new thing. If we were to start looking at it, if the government was to start getting involved, but it can happen in phases. And we can sort of collaborate on what we already have, you know, the community schools, the NGOs that are involved. Yeah. How do we get them to collaborate together to build a holistic system for this kid?
It's just extending a bit more. The resources are there. Yeah. The NGOs that are working on it are there. It's just, you know, how we can do more of it. Now, onto a bit of a pressing matter here at the present moment. Currently, there are thousands of refugees, like you said, just now dying at sea, you know, to make the journeys either here or to other Southeast Asian countries. This is not anything new. Yeah. We have seen this before. But it's worse this time of year. The UN agency recently said, you know, 2022 could be one of the deadliest years for especially Rohingya Muslims making their way here. So what's your take on this? You know, what is at stake here for the refugees and also for, you know, countries such as us? Heidi.
Yeah. I think, first of all, I'll be straight up to say that, like, I'm not heavily involved in issues with refugees being stuck at sea. I mean, we hear reports daily, but a lot of our involvement are on a case management basis, on the ground, because we don't have links, you know, to the people, to the maritime officers at sea, right? But I think, you know, when we think about it, right, like, from what I understand, protection of the right to life and a duty to rescue persons in distress at sea are the fundamental obligations under two specialized international law regimes that Malaysia should be adhering to, which are the International Human Rights Law and Law of Sea. And these rules, right, when read together, form a strong protection of human rights of the asylum seekers stranded at sea. However, often states fail to honour this obligation for various reasons. And we hear that, right, ranging from national security to economic reasons. But you know, when I think about it, right, I realize the deep privilege that we have as Malaysians, that we don't need to live in fear of political instability, you know, of having
wars.
To flee for of war, of persecution.
Yeah.
It's a rather peaceful country, right? But I'm mindful that this can one day be us.
Yeah.
It's just a moral and a humane obligation that if there are people stranded at sea, we should extend that humanity and that kindness to make sure that they are rescued.
Yeah.
You know, we can't have thousands and thousands of lives lost at sea simply because you go like, oh, we are worried
they're
about national security.
Yeah.
They're not
a
problem. They belong to another country. You know, Malaysians, we built so much on hospitality, right? And kindness and our generosity. And we're known for that, right? And I can only think that, you know what, we have enough resources and enough generosity and kindness to extend it to people who are stuck out there. Similarly, we often approach it this way, right? That it could have been one of us, it could be a family member, and how would we want to be responded to?
Yeah.
How we want to be treated, right? It's really as simple as that. It doesn't need to be complicated, I feel.
Yeah. What do you think, Hilda?
Yeah. I completely agree with
Heidi
that, you know, at any given time, anyone can be a refugee, right?
If you really strip down all the status, all the political affiliation and everything, you know, it can happen to any of us.
Yeah, and it's not a choice that they have. But I do think that if Malaysia steps up to do this, right, it does actually put Malaysia as a model country in willing to be able to take that stand and go like, hey, you know, we're not just looking at oh, if you're Malaysian, you know, we're looking at global care, you know, care being extended to whoever it is, because I know that it is my, you know, duty and responsibility as a human to care for others, right? I cannot turn a blind eye against it. So if the government were to do something about it, I do believe that it will build a lot of trust between the different countries and also for our local citizens, right? We'll be able to know that, hey, you know, our government has the right values in wanting to care for them.
Yeah, precisely on that point, right? Yeah. I think on that point, it's also realizing that, trust building, there are people that are saying that, like, okay, if you rescue one boat, you know, there's going to be expectation to bring in more boats, right? Yeah. There's going to be an encouragement for more refugees to enter our country. But I think it's not that people don't choose to leave their country because they would have no choice.
All right. Okay. We've tackled some of the issues regarding refugees, either here or even abroad. We'll go through the solutions for a comprehensive solution for refugees after this break. Hi, and welcome back to It's About Youth. I'm Fana Shea, and we are joined by Hilda from Project RED, as well as Heidi Kwa from Refuge for the Refugees. We have talked just now about some of the issues facing refugees here and also abroad. Now we want to go on to feasible solutions for dealing with refugees here. Now, Malaysia is especially, you know, in a unique position. Like you mentioned just now, we acknowledge that there's a huge Rohingya population here. And to a certain extent, we do lend a helping hand, but we are not signatories to the Refugee Convention. And like you said, like both of you mentioned just now, they are facing many difficult challenges here. So finding a middle ground, I would say, how important is it? And what would be feasible solutions moving forward, Heidi?
Yeah, I think some of the solutions moving forward, in order to treat refugees kindly, we don't need to be signatories of the Refugee Convention and Protocol, right? I think some of the solutions moving forward is looking into integration for refugees in our country. We can't deny their existence. And realistically, only 0.01% of all refugees worldwide ever gets resettled. This means that we have hundreds and thousands here in our country living their entire lifetime here.
Yeah.
So how do we look into integration? How do we look into making sure that they get access to job opportunities, access to education? Because as we have already discussed earlier in the show, access to job opportunities and access to education will benefit the nation as a whole. I think we also secondly need to look into how do we combat fear-mongering, right? Mm-hmm. Over the past decade, especially the past couple of years, there's been a lot of fear-mongering happening when it comes to refugees and migrants. You know, they're being called pati, refugees, migrants, there's no distinction, you know, you get, you know, a lot here going around saying that if you spot a refugee or migrant in your neighbourhood, call this hotline and report them, right? And because of things like this, people are scared. People then tend to look at refugees and migrants as people who are dangerous. And with fear-mongering happening, we see an increase in violence because people generally need to protect their safety. So I think the two things that we need to look into is how do we integrate refugees into our community without the need to give them citizenships, but also how do we combat fear-mongering by, you know, trying to assimilate them a little bit better and having, you know, just a kinder tone of voice when we talk about refugees and migrants. How do we educate the right more, right, about truly the distinction between refugees and migrants? Because, as Hilda has mentioned, right, when people are educated and people know the distinction between whom refugees and migrants and illegal immigrants, and when their fears are eased, that's when they can integrate better with the community.
What about you, Hilda? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do agree that integration is a way to get that. And I feel that, like, I think every time we think about this issue, it feels like too big of a mountain to conquer, right? There are too many things to focus on, right? And this can happen in stages, right? If there is education first, you know, we're thinking about education, how to provide a very holistic approach for them. And it may not be the natural pathway that, like, our kids in Malaysia might get, right? It might be something that is focused more on their pathways or, you know, what they can work as in the future. And then we slowly start crafting the jobs or the different pathways for them, right? So I think when it happens in stages, it's much more feasible. I think in 2017, the government did they hired 300 Rohingya refugees, you know, just to try it out. And I think that was a great initiative, to be honest, because it sort of gives us, you know, it gives us the experience to see whether does this work. We might think it works for them. Just like, I think for Project Red, when we started out, we had this great idea, you know. But only by talking to them and understanding that, hey, this might not actually be the greatest solution, then we're able to cater according to their needs.
So a bit of trial and error. Yes. A bit of, I guess, initiative, right?
Yeah.
Effort.
Yeah.
But it seems that over the past years, there has been still a lot of pushback when it comes to dealing with refugees and migrants. Like you said, it's too big of a mountain for either the government or any agencies to take on. So what's the issue here? You know, it's not just here, it's other countries as well.
Yeah.
Some say, you know, we don't have enough resources, some say, you know, they're contributing to economic drain, security threat, like you mentioned just now, the list goes on, right? Mm. Is there any implications for not having comprehensive solution, and also probably to counter that, benefits as well for having comprehensive solution, Heidi?
Yeah, I think first of all, we can't ignore that refugees and migrants exist. And when we don't have a comprehensive solution and a framework, it's really us ignoring that they exist, right?
It's like a big elephant in the room,
it's a big elephant in the room, hoping that, you know, they'll disappear, they'll stop entering our countries. And the reality is, it's not going to happen. So while they're here, how do we make the most of them, you know, being here in the country? How do we help them get assimilated to the country? I think, you know, sort of the implication of not, you know, coming up with comprehensive solutions is really being stuck with a generation of wasted skills and potential. We often, you know, after spending so much time with the community, I spent the past 11 years on the ground with the community, I see how much they're able to contribute. And I think it really baffles me that they're not given right avenues to contribute, right? Even during the COVID pandemic, we were doing a lot of food aid, right? And a lot of times people think of refugees and migrants and they think that they're just people, you know, with their hands stretched out asking for help, but they're not. Actually, the last thing that they want to ask for help, right? And they say, we want to contribute, you know? So how do we leverage on that? How do we create opportunities for that? Because the implication of not doing so is wasted skills and potential. And I often think about, you know, how much better our economy can be if refugees are allowed to work and contribute to the GDP. How else can we be creative as a nation to maximise the resources that we have?
It's like wasted potential, pretty much. All right, so we are in a new government right now with new ministers. Simply to say, what are your hopes for them when it comes to this issue, right? Home Minister, Dato' Sri Sabri Nasution, as well as the HR Minister, Dato' Sri Siva Kumar. Should they learn from the previous ministers or even government on how to handle this issue? I see you crunching your face a little bit. Essentially, what are your hopes for them? Hilda, you can go first.
So I do believe that, yes, there have been previous initiatives, but I think what's missing a lot is that they need to be on the ground. I personally learned a lot, and I am still learning. Like, I feel like every time I talk to a different community, a different family, I learn something new that goes like, oh, like, I didn't know that, you know, and it changes my view on how I see them, you know, on how the program should be. So I do feel that they should be on the ground to understand, to talk to the communities, talk to NGOs, organizations who have been doing this for a long time, you know, listen to their voices and then work together with them to come up with a solution. Because I think if the gap is always there, you know, if they do not see what's happening on the ground, we ourselves sometimes we have this misconception on what they actually need. And it may not be the best solution.
Yeah. So this miscommunication. Yeah. Going on. What about you?
I mean, this is the same standard that we hold to organizations, right, and team members that we bring on the ground. We constantly tell, I mean, a practice of our organization, Refuge Refugees, is that each time before we actually run a project, we gather stakeholders represented from refugee communities all across the board, every nationality, present them our ideas and seek feedback. Would it work? Would it not work? What do they think of it, right? Because we can't be crafting a solution for them without their input and their feedback. And similarly, you can't be forming policies in parliament and in government if you're not on the ground. You can't be forming effective policies if you're not on the ground. So I think similar to Hilda, you know, the ask of the Ministry of Home Affairs is to get on the ground, speak to us. And I think, you know, there's always that hesitance, right? Because they think that us NGOs are angry with the government and we're here to scrutinize them. We're not. We want to work together. We exist to work hand in hand and not against each other. And there's so much power in collaboration on tapping on each other's skills and resources and network. You know, in fact, the past 5-6 months, a few organizations and individuals have been coming together to run this campaign called Dari Dapur, from the kitchen, where we've spent 5-6 months going into kongsis, into plantations, meeting chefs in the refugee and migrant community, and having them cook dishes that represent home, right? So we've had Burmese food, there's Indonesian food, we've got Nepali food, right? And then, you know, after they've cooked the meal, we sit around the table and have conversations with them. And that's where that deepened our understanding. Malaysians, we love to eat, right? And what better way to unite over food? And so actually April onwards, we're starting, April 2023 onwards, we're starting public dinner parties where the public can come by, where parliamentarians can come by for a meal, for a conversation in the most non-threatening way, to get to know each other, just so that we can combat fear-mongering, we can combat xenophobia, but we can also understand each other's journey. You know, we can humanise the plight of refugees and migrants.
There's really need to be a bridge, you know, to closer this gap between what we perceive refugees are and who they really are.
Correct.
All right, there you have it. Hilda from Project Red, as well as Heidi from Refuge for the Refugees, talking about some of the issues faced by refugees and some of the more feasible solutions that we can take moving forward. I'm Fanashe, and this is It's About Youth. Thank you for watching.